The extra E for EESG puts a focus on the employees.
But we do still have a lot of people who have never started a SPAC and are asking about how to do it and come in with great ideas.
It was a board full of rock stars, quite frankly.
They say, you know, in M&A, as in life, the best contracts are ones that you never have to look at.
Welcome to the second part of Command Financial's Corporate Compliance Roundtable, in partnership with us, Insightia. Part one featured a panel of Inside Counsel debating a variety of trending topics, such as new rules from the SEC and NASDAQ Stock Exchange, say-on-pay proposals, diversity, and ESG disclosure, to name just a few. Whereas this episode has a panel of external counsel. Don't worry if you haven't heard the first one yet, it doesn't actually matter which one you listen to first. Of course, you've got to listen to both, but it doesn't matter which you listen to first. So since 2015, Command Financial has gathered industry experts every year at the Yale Club in New York. But due to the COVID-19 pandemic, we are once again bringing it to you in the comfort of your own home. I'm Kieran Paul, and today I am joined by Lena Tettelbaum and Sebastian Niles, both of whom are partners in the corporate department of Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen and Katz. Joining them is Kai Leekefet, a partner at Sidley Austin and co-chair of its shareholder activism practice. And alongside Kai is his Sidley colleague, David Nee, who specialises in special purpose acquisition companies, or SPACs. Before we start though, let's hear from Tony Lind, Senior Vice President and partner at Command Financial. So Tony, just like last year, it was a great inside panel. What are you excited hearing debated in this external counsel panel?
For sure, Karen. I thought it was a very good segment, and I'm really looking forward to segment number two with the outside counsel. And we talk about ESG, and we talk about SPACs, and we hear from our friends at Wachtell about EESG. So sit back and enjoy, and hopefully you'll learn a thing or two, and thank you for listening.
So let's kick off with Lena and Sebastian of Wachtell. Delighted to have you both.
Delighted to be here with all of you.
Thanks, Kieran. Great to be here. Thanks for having us.
Now, Wachtell has frequently used this acronym, EESG. Now, you didn't hear me wrong there. It's two E's. So why the extra E, and what should companies do about it?
Yes, I confess we're contributing to what I call the alphabet soup, you know, the explosion of various acronyms. This is one, though, that whatever the acronym used, we do believe it's critical for public companies, especially, to recognize that they're operating in a new environment. It's a new environment of heightened expectations. There's a spotlight not only on their, you know, financial and operating performance, but a spotlight on their EESG and stakeholder-linked performance. And so stepping back a moment in this era of corporate purpose, of, in a sense, an inclusive capitalism, employees and human capital and worker-related matters are really coming to the fore. The typical term of ESG, right, environmental, social, and governance, what we've been seeing, whether it's from the engagement or pressure from institutional investors, the pressure brought to bear our proxy advisory firms, you know, the lived experience on the ground of companies navigating through the pandemic, navigating through obviously just a whole set of items, you know, right now, obviously around supply chain, inflation, you know, and the like. The extra E for EESG puts a focus on the employees. We've been seeing when it comes to, again, employees, heightened potential for employee activism, including employees discovering that they too are shareholders and perhaps can invoke 1408 proposal rights. We see in activist proxy fights and contested elections or contested proposal situations, the dissidents very aggressively seeking to solicit a company's own employees right, and broader stakeholder base. And we see the institutional investors seeking to, at a minimum, understand, if not also hold to account, a board and a management team as to how are they, you know, prioritizing and navigating employee talent and these broader human capital related themes. I'd also note that in this new context or this new era, concepts of diversity, equity, and inclusion, right, the DE&I, have been placed very high on the investor agenda. And not only, obviously, for companies deciding that there is a very important role for the private sector to play and lead, you know, certainly the S, right, the social impact, communities, but, you know, within the corporation, both at the employee workforce level, also at the board level, right, interest in board development and board diversity and board skill sets. But, you know, also throughout, how's a company thinking about the supply chain, their business partners, their vendors, the customers? You know, when it comes to this, you know, this E of the employees and that falls within it, human capital, investors are having high expectations around disclosures around, for example, DE&I topics, but also, again, going beyond that. And just as with all ESG-related items, you know, certainly obviously climate change, you know, within their environment, but also interestingly, other items within the environment. Investors are looking to understand what's the board's role in oversight of these issues. And that reaches the board's role, including through committees of employee-related matters, essentially sort of the people strategy, as it were.
And of course, what is hot right now is the M&A market. But we've also seen a few deals fail. So what are the best precautions that companies involved in a transaction should take?
Absolutely. The last few years have had many forces that have led to a very pro M&A environment, which we're very happy about at Wachtell, like companies that were in need of liquidity, sold off non-core business lines, and that created opportunities for buyers like private equity funds with a lot of dry powder. And of course, there were all these market dislocations relating to COVID that presented opportunities for buyers that frankly just weren't as viable when the markets were at record highs. But as you point out, what COVID giveth in terms of M&A, it also taketh in terms of a number of broken deals. Like, you know, some of these deals, they were terminated voluntarily because the business deal just no longer made sense. Others were recut at a different price. And others went to litigation over whether or not there was an obligation to consummate the deal. I think in terms of what precautions companies involved in a transaction should take, I think sometimes in M&A, clients are a bit skeptical about the value that lawyers can add to a transaction. I think sometimes clients believe the legal aspects is more of a papering exercise once the business people have struck their deal. And I think if the COVID-19 pandemic has taught M&A practitioners and their clients anything, it's that the words of the contract really do matter to protecting the benefit of the bargain. When COVID first hit, Sebastian and I can both remember that clients, you know, and us and their lawyers with outstanding deals went scrambling to look at purchase agreements they had to see what arguments were available to them or the other side to either force the deal or get out of it. That's a really scary place to be for a deal that you already announced. And you saw that the contracts really were across the board. For example, the question of whether the word pandemics were treated as an express carve-out to the material adverse effect clause. And where it wasn't, there were maybe other words that could be used. Like we all had to think about, is a pandemic an act of God? Is the pandemic a, quote, natural disaster? Frankly, this exercise was really a lot about leverage and trying to convince the other side that you had the better of the argument in order to maybe recut the deal or threaten the other side to not try and recut the deal. But even separate and aside from COVID, there were all these questions about, you know, what companies could do or not do in terms of their interim operating covenant. Companies have to agree in these purchase agreements to operate in the, quote, ordinary course of business. You know, what does that really mean when you have this unprecedented global pandemic? No one wanted to take any action or fail to take an action that would jeopardize the deal because it was not in the ordinary course. So you had all these questions that clients were really thinking about for the first time. But for M&A practitioners like us at Wachtell, we think about this stuff all the time. It's our job to try and think about the corner cases. They say, you know, in M&A, as in life, the best contracts are ones that you never have to look at. You know, things just go great and the parties are both motivated to work together and they never have to look at the two-page MAE provision. It's a distant memory. But every M&A agreement I've seen over the last year, maybe not everyone, but most of them, you know, has some provision dealing with COVID now. And that just shows you how quickly the M&A practice can really catch up to world events. So I think in terms of what companies are doing now, thinking ahead, is they're just a lot more rigorous about analyzing their specific risks. I've seen clients say, you know, it occurs to me, maybe we're in a sector that's particularly vulnerable to protests. Can we make sure that that doesn't qualify as an MAE? And there's language that's developed about that. Or maybe you're in a geographic area that is particularly likely to get hit with the effects of climate change. And you want to make sure there's no question that a buyer with second thoughts can walk away from a deal over that. So I just think it's important for, you know, clients undertaking M&A on both sides, not to treat the purchase agreement process as something secondary to the deal or a necessary evil. Each deal really does pose its own set of risk factors, and it's important that there's a clear meeting of the minds as to who bears each risk. Of course, you know, it's not just the contract that's getting extra focus in M&A. I think even the way diligence is being conducted has changed. There's more focus on supply chain and customer satisfaction and topics, the ESG, EESG topics that Sebastian just discussed. And there's a real evaluation by the parties, maybe I'd call it a reevaluation, as to who is in the best position to evaluate the right response to the next shock or crisis that might come. You know, sometimes the buyer wants as much control as possible because they're going to be the ones on the hook for whatever money gets paid for that response. But I think more and more buyers start thinking, we don't necessarily want to have a consent right over everything that can slow you down. We want you to do the right thing. We trust you, the target, to know your customers and your suppliers and your employees because it's your business. And so these are conversations we're regularly having with clients in terms of how to allocate, you know, who's the one that kind of manages a response to an issue as it arises between signing and closing.
And of course, with COVID-19, we've lost the personal touch in some cases. And how impactful has that been?
We're absolutely seeing the full range from deals where principals and advisors, we all gather together in a conference room and hammer out the outstanding issues. But I've also been involved in deals where I think the entire transaction, start to finish, originated over Zoom and phone calls. And I do think something gets lost when there isn't that personal relationship that gets developed and that trust built. Because so many of the thorniest issues, the best way through them involves a little bit of trusting, you know, that incentives are aligned, that the people will do the right thing. And I think that when there's trust established among the principals and even among advisors, I think you can go a long way of, you know, getting through issues. But we're watching deal dynamics evolving as people come out of their various COVID protocols. Really, clients need to choose the moments wisely when you really need to look someone in the eye and read their body language and see if there's a path forward. I'll conclude by saying that if you find yourself with a deal signed up today, you should really stay coordinated with your lawyers and stay vigilant about getting their input before you take any key actions. There's just so many judgment calls that go into interpreting a contract. All the time we're asked by our clients, oh my gosh, this thing happened. Do we think it gives the other side a right to walk away? Or we want to do this thing. Do we have to ask the other side? And if we're asked, we can come up with the right strategy that accomplishes your business objectives, but also protects the deal. We can do that together. But sometimes we only hear about, you know, somebody did something after the fact, and maybe it was a technical breach of the agreement. And now, you know, your side is just doing damage control. So I think when you sign a deal, just try and get the key decision makers really sensitive to the company's obligation and develop really good hygiene around asking the right questions of your lawyers and advisors before you are in that situation.
And being hot right now means M&A activism is on the rise. So how can management teams and boards counter the threat and emerge unscathed?
I think we all know that a large driver of activism is some kind of economic thesis. And a thesis that activists love is one that is tied to M&A in some manner. And we've been consistently seeing activist campaigns with an M&A thesis of some kind accounts for maybe a little less than half the activist campaigns in a given year. But first, I just want to add, maybe to clarify your question a bit, you know, what M&A activism is, because there are different kinds, and the strategies that a company would take to defend itself, of course, depends on the kind of activism you're facing. So I'd say M&A activism falls into roughly three buckets. First, there are activist campaigns to sell the target company, full stop. This kind of activism either pushes the board to announce a strategic alternative process geared at exploring a sale of itself, or sometimes the activist is actually talking about a specific deal. So the activist can team up with a private equity fund, they make an offer, and they tell the shareholders, look at this great deal, sell yourself to us because this is the best opportunity for shareholders to get out ahead rather than go down with the ship of your failing corporate strategy. The second bucket is a subset. It's M&A activism aimed at breaking up a target company without, you know, a full sale. So maybe having the target company divest a non-core business line. And again, the activist can be pushing this as a general idea targeted at some specific businesses, or they could be the actual, again, proposed counterparty to the transaction. And even if they're not making the offer, sometimes they'll say, oh, we can be a very helpful financing source in making sure this deal gets done. And finally, the third bucket, and this touches a little bit about what I just talked about in terms of existing deals, it's activism that tries to scuttle or improve the terms of an existing deal. And what's interesting here is that this kind of activism isn't just limited to the target shareholders trying to get a higher price from the buyer. In fact, we're seeing activists insert themselves on the buy side of an acquisition, trying to kill a deal that they don't think the buyer should have agreed to. We saw this in Starboard's challenge to Bristol Myers Squibb's acquisition of Celgene, and Icon launched a campaign against Occidental's acquisition of Anadarko. And there's other examples out there, you know, including examples where non-traditional activists, you know, institutional investors are actually weighing in on the buy side when they don't necessarily think that the business thesis is sound. As I said, the way to potentially prevent or mitigate such attacks really depends on what we're talking about. So I'll start with just first two categories. You know, the company isn't actually contemplating M&A, but it wants to be prepared to fend off criticisms that it should either sell itself or a part of itself. And I think that the way to manage this is companies need to be regularly reviewing their portfolio and direction, so they can explain why something does not make sense. Maybe you hear these questions from your investors at your quarterly earnings calls. Hey, have you thought through whether this asset would be better off spun or divested? Have you looked at that? And it doesn't mean that a company has to, you know, spend all this money and launch a public strategic exploration with bankers and third parties and run this whole process. But it could mean that you dedicate a board meeting just to refresh the board as to why that part of your business is better off with you rather than traded separately. Maybe you have good evidence that a third party buyer just isn't going to see the value that you do. Maybe the market won't recognize the value. Maybe that part of your business fulfills a key function that if you tried to outsource to a third party, you would end up paying much more. And as much as it pains a Wachtell-Lipton lawyer to say it, there are lots of reasons why M&A does not make sense. And you have to have those arguments handy, both in the ordinary course of your conversations with your investors, but also should the day arise that, you know, an activist decides to use this to make a case for change on the board. And, you know, the rest of the advice is very similar to what I'm sure you've heard from others on the panel in terms of just what the board should be doing to stay vigilant against activism in general. Monitoring your trading and ownership and your securities and looking for unusual activity to see if there's maybe some would-be acquirers out there or similar players, you know, regularly reviewing your company's structural defenses and governance profiles. No one is saying in the current climate that you should be, you know, implementing a classified board or, you know, other provisions like that. But there are incremental protections that you could consider. For example, you could make sure that you have a rights plan on the shelf, you know, so that you could adopt it very quickly if the circumstances warrant. And you should also really know what advisors you would call upon should the day arise that you get this kind of M&A activism at your company. And I think we've certainly worked with a lot of companies to help make sure that they can hit the ground running from the moment that they smell trouble. And we work with bankers and PR firms and really assemble a defensive strike team for when the moment should arise. I think the last point I'll say is, if we're talking about protecting a specific deal, again, it of course matters whether you are the buyer or the seller and whether the activism is on your side or the other side. In terms of things that companies can do, well, it actually starts at the structuring and negotiation phase of the M&A deal. If you're the target, you know, you should see, is a shareholder vote really needed in the transaction on the buy side? If the buyer's offering stock, maybe you can negotiate the stock component to be below 20% so that there's only a vote on your side. And that takes some of the risk off of the table in terms of where the activist can show up. Second, you can consider whether the deal is a good candidate for being structured as a tender offer. This structure also can lead to activism, but candidly, the transaction timeline can be so fast in a tender offer that it's harder for an activist to run a full campaign if you're structuring it without a shareholder vote. You know, third, I think parties need to just look really carefully at the provisions of the purchase agreement that speak to the meeting dynamics, how often you can postpone your your special meeting, who has to consent, just to make sure there's real alignment into each other's meetings and how they'll be handled. At the end of the day, if you're on the target side and you get an activist that's just trying to put more pressure on the buyer for more money, that might not be the end of the world for your shareholder. They may even end up better in some scenarios. If you're on the target side and you get an activist on the buyer side trying to get the buyer shareholders to just vote down the deal, that's a very different story. That puts your entire deal at risk, which is why I think the best advice is just to be able to explain the value proposition to each set of shareholders that is voting. And you have to do this really thoughtfully and be sensitive. Because if there's a vote on both sides, as much as you want to say as a target, hey, trust us, you want this deal, the buyer is giving us an unprecedented premium, they're totally overpaying, that's going to make it harder for the buyer to get their vote if they look like they're overpaying. So I think you have to just be really coordinated and have thoughtful messaging. And that's the advice that we give for all kinds of activism. I don't know, Sebastian, if you have anything you'd like to add to that.
I think, look, in this bucket of the intersection between activism and M&A, you know, as Lena highlighted, there's the aspect where the activist demand, right, which, by the way, certainly still comes from traditional activist hedge funds, but increasingly we're seeing institutional investors acting like activists in various regards, but, you know, pushing for a sale of the company. I think I might expand a little bit what we're seeing in that area, how they're doing it. Certainly there's the, you know, publicly calling for a sale, but there's also, you know, other kinds of pressure tactics. So there's, you know, the activists leaking or initiating rumors of an unsolicited approach, you know, activists acting as essentially unauthorized intermediaries with strategic acquirers, investment banks, private equity funds, sometimes taking positions in both the target and the acquirer, but also an activist making their own essentially a stalking horse bid for the company, even as a significant size shareholder or formally partnering with a hostile bidder to build, you know, some kind of substantial position to facilitate an ultimate takeover. You know, or if it's someone coming in to try to interfere, right, with a planned M&A strategy. Look, I think, you know, most companies are heeding the advice that, you know, the board needs to be working with management to anticipate all of these types of activist attacks, takeover attempts, you know, private unsolicited, you know, soft approaches from private equity funds or strategic buyers or what have you. Keep those response playbooks, you know, up to date, you know, at meeting at least annually with the team of the corporation's, you know, executives and outside advisors that would advise the corporation in the event of, you know, either a takeover proposal, an activist attack, or, you know, just getting preferred M&A done. And, you know, when it just comes to desired, you know, M&A, if a company can do everything it can to avoid premature disclosure, right, and having a strategy for preventing and managing leaks, it's very important. You know, premature disclosure, it impedes control of messaging. It may yield avoidable, you know, opposition and interlopers. And I think also just that momentum for any kind of announcement, whether it's a merger, an acquisition, a separation, you know, transaction, the momentum really is established in those first hours following that first announcement. And so getting that day one rollout and communication plan and, you know, being very thoughtful around what is the right content that ought to be in that announcement, including whether, you know, should it include or could it include disclosures that years ago people might have said, well, I'll wait to make these kinds of disclosures around the ultimate benefits or plans for the deal. I'll wait until closing. Now you have to be very thoughtful of, well, is there some additional information that we ought to put into the market sooner rather than later?
And his final question to you both, and we've asked this to our inside panel, so it'd be interesting to see how your answers differ to theirs. What do you expect the biggest issue of the 2022 proxy season to be?
The biggest issue, I would say, really has to be thought of in two buckets. You know, the first bucket is we're going to see an explosion of shareholder proposals go to a vote around these EESG related themes. You know, the SEC is also going to take themselves out of the business of decreeing that, you know, EESG related proposals sort of unduly micromanage a company or interfere with ordinary business operations or, you know, don't involve significant social or policy issues, you know, assuming the proposal is drafted, you know, correctly. And that's occurring at the same time that the big institutional investors and, of course, the proxy advisory firms are much more willing than ever before to vote in favor of a proposal, you know, and essentially even against the board's recommendation. And how companies navigate that, again, it's going to come in all sorts of areas, obviously climate, but other environmental and social topics, DE&I, you know, issues there. And I think related to that is, oh, well, how does a company demonstrate responsiveness to a proposal that received substantial, you know, majority support, including where there's some concern of, well, if you implemented this, might it have an adverse effect on value versus it's something that, you know, actually can be, you know, implemented without creating too many vulnerabilities or threats to a company. And I think the second, you know, bucket, when we think of what's going to be significant that companies are planning for now for the 2022 proxy season, is the contested election, right? Whether it's the economic activist hedge fund deciding I'm going to run to replace the full board or a minority of the board in order to advance, you know, a broader economic agenda, right? Sell the company, break up the company, improve margins, you know, otherwise have improved business operational performance or, you know, get that stock price up as soon as possible, return the capital to shareholders. You know, the activists are recruiting candidates in that regard and will be putting up slates to stand side by side with the company's directors. You know, and we'll see how new SEC rules around universal proxy cards, you know, and the like, which is distinct from proxy access, how that, you know, plays into that. But, you know, the contested election and relatedly on this concept of the board being under pressure and spotlight and directors themselves being targeted for attacks or replacement, we're going to see more withhold votes against directors this coming season, right? Where even if there isn't a competing slate, you know, put up, and perhaps the competing slate, by the way, may try to invoke or sound EESG related themes, either as a wedge issue or as actually a fundamental part of the campaign to replace directors. We're going to see more big institutional investors and the proxy advisory firms recommending adverse votes against directors for whether it's financial performance issues or perceived non-responsiveness or to, again, accelerate progress on a particular EESG-related topic. And how companies, you know, navigate that, it's going to be at one of the highest levels that we've ever seen in the 2022 vote, but also hopefully, you know, diffuse it, you know, get ahead of it and, you know, implement, you know, what we think of as some new playbooks for dealing with that. So I think those are some of the items for the 2022 proxy season. But obviously prefer if it was a much more boring season so companies can, you know, just continue to focus on the business, but that's not what we're expecting to occur.
Did you know you can sign up for a free trial now of Activist Insight Shorts on our website? Activist Insight Shorts provides you with timely alerts on new activist short selling campaigns and allows you to screen by share price returns, allegations, short seller tactics, and company responses. Request a 30-minute demo now of all of our products, which also include Activist Insight Online, Activist Insight Governance, and Activist Insight Vulnerability by visiting our website. Let's now turn to our panelists from Sidley Austin. So welcome, Kai.
Thank you very much for having me.
So your firm helped deliver Starboard Value's first loss in a proxy fight since 2012. So how did Box beat one of Wall Street's most prolific activists?
Yeah, that's a question we hear quite often these days. And please forgive me if I cannot be too specific here, because obviously Box is a client and I cannot share any attorney-client privilege information. But what I can tell you is that this was obviously a very closely watched proxy contest. And you should assume that the advisor team was aware of the fact that Starbot had not lost a proxy fight since 2012 when they lost their contest at AOL. Since then, Starbot had initiated almost 100 proxy contests and not lost. Needless to say, a lot of companies, when they were facing Starbot, decided to plant the white flag pretty early on in the process, because there was a widespread assumption on Wall Street that Starbot was unbeatable. When you look at the final vote totals, you will see that Starbot failed to garner more than 15% of the outstanding shares to support their campaign. And that cannot really explain solely by the lack of ISS support. In fact, Starbot did receive support from Glass Lewis, the other proxy advisory firm. So what happened? A lot of pundits believed Starbot was about to win this proxy contest. And they were looking from the outside in, saw the arguments, saw the press, saw smaller shareholders issuing press releases or otherwise coming out in support of Starbot, and assumed that that would be symptomatic for the overall sentiment of the shareholders. But that's oftentimes not true. And I think that is something that is important as a takeaway, is that from the outside in doesn't always give you all the necessary pieces of information to understand how a proxy fight is really going. What really matters in a proxy contest at a company like Box, where the vast majority of the shareholders are highly sophisticated institutional shareholders, is less what you read in a daily press release from the activist or what you see pundits say on the 20,000 foot level. What really matters is how these sophisticated institutional investors make their decision. These investors are rarely swayed by populistic argument. They go into the detail of a contest and they make a decision based on the merits after many, many hours of deep research. And what the likes of BlackRock, Vanguard, and other highly sophisticated institutional investors are looking for is, well, how does the board behave in a situation like this? How do they respond to crisis? How do they respond to criticism? How flexible is the board? How responsive is the board? When you looked at the board of the company, you'd found that there were 7 new directors within the last 3 years alone. It was a board full of rock stars, quite frankly, when you look at where else they were serving. This was not a board that was clinging to their jobs. In fact, within the last 6 months, several of the companies that board members were sitting on were actually sold, making the point that this board was not against a sale of the company at the right price. It was a board that was just trying to do what they deeply believe was the right thing to do. And at the end of the day, the board garnered the support of the most institutional investors and the likes of ISS and won decisively because of that.
Do you think proxy voting advisors are starting to turn against activists?
It's a question that has been debated intensively among advisors to companies and activists alike. 2021 was an interesting year on that front. We've seen ISS side with companies and proxy fights more often than in any other year over the last decade. Interestingly, though, while ISS appeared to be more board-friendly, Glass Lewis took a turn to the other side and in a number of situations came out against a company, even though ISS supported the board. So I would, first of all, make the distinction between ISS and Glass Lewis here. Second of all, I would like to note that, and that is really what I tell everybody who comes with that thesis to me, is that we are talking about a very small subset of activist situations. We are having hundreds of activist situations in corporate America and worldwide every year. And only a fraction of these situations go actually to a proxy fight. In the United States, it's typically 80 to 100. At Sittling, we had 22 this year. most of the matters that go to a proxy fight don't actually go all the way. They don't get to a stage where ISS and Glass-Lewis issuing their vote recommendations. The vast majority of these contests are actually settled before ISS and Glass-Lewis issue the vote report. So we are talking about an extraordinarily small sample size of matters where ISS and Glass-Lewis weigh in. And well, as in any other area of life, the smaller the sample size, maybe the less telling is the outcome. So I wouldn't read too much into it. At the end of the day, I deeply believe that ISS and Glass-Lewis, while I not always concur with the outcome, they are working really, really hard, and they're generally trying to come to the right conclusion. And it just so happened that in 2021, the number of matters where they, in close calls, decided to side with the company were more prevalent than in the past. But I don't think that the approach has changed in any form or shape.
And Kai, of course, we haven't seen a lot of activists pushing companies to sell themselves, at least explicitly anyway. Is this merely an aesthetic change?
Yes, this is really optics. At the end of the day, 90-95% of all activist campaigns, at least against small and mid-cap companies, are about pushing the company into a sale. That is typically plan A for an activist. And it's easy to understand why, right? I mean, take, for example, an activist who invests at $10 a share in a company and then harasses the target company long enough and succeeds in convincing the company to sell the company at, let's say, $15. Well, that activist just was able to generate a 50% profit in a relatively short time frame. It's understandable that this is plan A for activists. Now, why do they not explicitly advocate for this plan A? That is really the interesting question. That's because activists have become smarter about this in recent years. They've started to realize that ISS and Glass-Lewis and the all-important index funds, BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street, typically are reluctant to support an activist campaign that is merely geared towards pushing the company into a sale. That doesn't mean that this does not remain the goal of an activist in many campaigns. It does. But they have become smarter about it, and they are hiding the ball a little bit more cleverly than in the past.
And finally, Kai, and we're going to touch on SPACs with your colleague David Nee in a minute, but how could activists use a SPAC in a campaign?
Yeah, that is, I think, one of the most interesting developments over the last year and a half. The rise of SPACs and its impact on shareholder activism as a whole. I mean, first of all, what we are going to see, we've already started to see behind the scenes, is that activists will go after SPACs very quickly. SPACs should not expect a honeymoon or grace period like IPO companies oftentimes enjoy of a few years. Activists will come after SPACs pretty hard, pretty soon, to the extent SPAC's management is not delivering on the lofty projections that were made at the time of the de-SPAC transaction. But the equally interesting question is the one that you just raised, which is there were a lot of activists who actually decided to form their own SPAC. Pershing Square, Starboard Value, Engage Capital, I could go on and on. There were at least 10 activists who formed their own in the last 1.5 years. And the interesting question for me is, are they going to use these SPACs just like the other sponsors, meaning they are just going to be on the lookout for private companies, for unicorns to take public? Or are they going to use these SPACs to go hostile against existing public companies? We have not seen the latter all too much just yet. But this is a development I fully expect to see in the next 3 years. Activists are going to go hostile against other public companies using public vehicles they create.
So as I mentioned, that leads us on nicely to hearing now from a SPAC specialist in Sidley's David Nee.
Great. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So David, tell us what you've worked on this year regarding SPACs.
a lot of work involving SPACs in all different directions. We represented placement agents and connection with a few SPACs, the LGL Systems acquisition or business combination with IronNet, Fortress Value business combination with ATI Physical. Also represented a lot of target SPACs and sellers in connection with these SPACs as well, including the Sia Healthcare business combination with Lumera DX and the Git Capital merger with UpHealth and CloudBreak. On the SPAC IPO front, been a very busy year, lots and lots of SPAC IPOs, including the TradeUp Global SPAC IPO last year, the first that got equity treatment after the SEC put out the warrant liability guidances, as well as some recent ones like LearnCW, Lionheart, and Git Capital 3.
Would you say the frequency of SPACs used as a strategy will increase or decrease next year in 2022?
I would bifurcate that answer. I think there are two worlds in the SPAC world. There's the SPAC IPO world, which is the formation of SPAC IPOs by sponsors who want to use that vehicle to find acquisition targets. And then there's the other world of these SPACs, where once a SPAC IPOs, it goes out and finds a target and does a business combination with them. In terms of SPAC IPOs, I think that it will continue to go up just based on watching the trends in our own pipeline. While there has been a pretty big bump in the road in the last few months, it's still a very popular product. We still have a lot of backlog and we still get a lot of inbounds. And the market overall in the SPAC IPOs has gotten a lot better in the last few weeks. So very optimistic and believe that while we may never achieve the hike that we had earlier this year, that it's definitely on an upward trajectory and we'll continue to see plenty of SPAC IPOs. On the de-SPAC front, which is where a target considers a SPAC as a way to go public in lieu of, say, initial public offering or a direct listing, I do think that it will continue to be looked on as a means to go public by targets. It offers a lot of advantages. Traditional IPOs and direct listings do not. And so even though there might be bumps in the road, I do think that it will continue to be and will increasingly be used as a means for private companies to go public.
And someone's going to lead the way in SPAC creation. So who do you think that will be next year?
I think that the leaders of SPAC creation will be the serial sponsors, right? The likes of Dan Hennessy and Shamat and Social Capital and Avi Git Capital and some of the institutional serial sponsors like Goldman, Cantor, and so on. These players have a lot of experiences forming SPACs, running SPACs, and finding good targets at good valuations. So they have, I think, a system in place that allows it to be just great for everyone. And I think they'll continue to go with it. I do think that newer SPAC sponsors will continue to be a driver in the market, maybe not as much as the serial sponsors, but we do still have a lot of people who have never started a SPAC and are asking about how to do it and come in with great ideas. And so the vehicle is really good for first-time issuers because it's not that complicated and it's fairly easy to grasp. And I do think that will be a driver next year as well in SPAC creation.
And naturally, a lot is made of the high-profile launch of Pershing Square Tonting Holdings back in July last year. Do you think that was the catalyst for others looking to create SPACs?
I don't think that was a catalyst, although it helped significantly. I think the bigger catalysts were some of the more high-profile de-SPACs that occurred even before that. So think DraftKings and Virgin Galactics and Nikolai. Those were really the ones that really helped SPACs get on the radar and take off. The Persian one made the news. It was the largest and continues, I believe, to be the largest SPAC IPO. That's obviously gotten a lot of attention. Since then, we've had a lot of other high-profile SPACs. I think all of those really helped contribute to the development of the SPAC market by bringing attention. I don't think it was the one that was the catalyst, but it helped a lot because it did bring a whole lot of attention to the SPAC market.
And continuing on Pershing Square, do you think the litigation against it will have any lasting impacts on SPACs as a whole?
Personally, I do not. The litigation is an attempt to, in my opinion, legislate by litigating. The litigators, the plaintiffs have actually gone on record that they're using the litigation to seek to reform the SPAC market. And I think nothing is more telling than the fact that when that litigation became publicized, over 60 of the biggest law firms in the nation came together and put out a joint statement effectively challenging the basis of the litigation. And so it's very hard to get 60 law firms or even two or three law firms to agree to anything. And so I think that's a very telling perspective of the merits of the litigation. But I do think, though, that it will be ultimately very good because the SPAC market is very nascent and we do need challenges to really help see even test it out. We need every corner to be really explored and we need the market to be challenged because that's what will help it become a very mature, developed market. So litigations like that, while, you know, in of itself may not be good, I think in the long run would be good for the market because it really helps tease out the weaknesses.
And I was just wondering, is there a limit to the amount of SPACs that can be out there? Like, is there a finite amount?
In reality, there is a finite number because there are only so many targets that are public ready, right? And plus are willing to consider the SPAC route versus a traditional IPO out there. And so at some point, you're going to have more SPACs than you will have targets. But the SPAC market has gotten very creative. So one thing that a lot of sponsors are now doing are forming Cayman SPACs that look to targets in distant parts of the world where the sponsor thinks that it has an advantage or where other people are not looking, right? Latin America, Southeast Asia, South Asia, Europe, all over the world. I mean, Africa. Or they're going after industries or investment theses that they don't think other sponsors can really pull off. Right. So this level of creativity and adventurism, I think, in my opinion, allows the market to be opened up. But still, at some point, you're going to run out of targets, even in those very esoteric markets. And so what's going to happen is that's not going to stop SPACs from forming. Right. There'll always be people or sponsors who think that they'll do things differently or they'll be successful where others are not. And they'll continue to form SPACs. But you'll get to a situation where more and more SPACs are going to start to fail. And then what's going to happen is it's going to depress the market and that will be a deterrent for newer sponsors who are not as confident from entering into the market. So it will lead to a market balance, in my opinion. But I think we're a bit far away from that point because I think there's still a lot of markets that sponsors have yet to explore or explore fully.
That's it for our two special panel episodes. We hope you have enjoyed them as much as we enjoyed making them, and we hope you gained some key insights. If so, please do rate and review the podcast on whichever platform you are using. Finally, my thanks once again to Tony Lind of Command Financial for making these happen. I'm Kieran Paul, thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode of the Activist Insight podcast.